We learned about fatty acids. We looked at the chemical structure and functional groups of fatty acids. We said that lipids, their functional groups were fatty acids. And the subfunctional groups of lipids, or the functional groups of fatty acids, however you want to look at it, were a hydrocarbon chain and a carboxyl group. And carboxyl was COOH. Okay. And so if we look at this picture here, we can see the long hydrocarbon chain right here. Okay. Then we have the carboxyl group here, carbon double bonded to an oxygen, single bonded to an OH group. Okay. And so this is a fatty acid. This one here happens to be saturated. We then talked about condensation and hydrolysis reactions. We said that all molecules, at least all biological molecules, are formed through the process of condensation, and you can break them down through the process of hydrolysis. Okay. And so what we want to look is specifically is at the condensation process that occurs with lipids. Typically what happens is lipids not only have fatty acids, but many of them will also have a molecule called glycerol. You don't really need to memorize the molecule of glycerol here, but notice that it has OH groups off the glycerol molecule. Essentially what happens during condensation with the fatty acid and the glycerol molecule is the OH group from the carboxyl end of the fatty acid breaks off. So this bond breaks right here. The bond between the oxygen and hydrogen on the glycerol molecule breaks. And then what's going to happen is this carbon is going to bond to this oxygen, giving off a water. Therefore, water appearing or condensation, which we talked about. All right. So something like a fat is produced by going through three different condensation reactions and adding three different fatty acids to a glycerol molecule. Over here we have the long hydrocarbon chain. What this CH2 parentheses 16 means is that there's 16 of these CH2s. Okay, so we have the long fatty or the long hydrocarbon chain, the carboxyl group here, the COOH, and what happens is the OH group from the carboxyl and the hydrogen group from the glycerol molecule, both of those bonds break and the water is given off. Okay, down here is actually it has it listed here as well. And then the fatty acid actually attaches to the oxygen of the glycerol molecule. If this occurs three different times, of course we're going to get three waters. It's three separate condensation reactions. And this is what we would call a fat. A fat is when you have three fatty acids attached to one glycerol molecule. Okay? Any questions about that? Now, not all lipids are fats. There are other types of lipids besides fat. This is another fat that's actually showing here. This is actually an unsaturated fat because there's this double bond here, or point of unsaturation. But you can see there are three fatty acid molecules here, right here, attached to a glycerol molecule. You can tell because they're attached to this oxygen of the glycerol molecule. Any questions about that? Maybe one of the most important lipids, at least for biology, is something that we call a phospholipid. Okay, phospholipids are going to be very important when we talk about membrane structure in the cell. And notice here that the phospholipid is very similar to a fat. We have the glycerol molecule here, and we have two fatty acids attached to the glycerol molecule. The main difference is that we don't have three fatty acids. Instead of the third fatty acid, what we have is we have a group that has a phosphorus in it, which is represented by the letter P, or a phosphate group. Okay? So a phospholipid, we have two fatty acids attached to a glycerol molecule, and then a phosphate group that's attached to the glycerol molecule as well. When we look at the structure of a phospholipid, what we find is that the part of the molecule is hydrophilic, okay, and part is hydrophobic. And we haven't used those terms before, but we talked about polarity, right? The top part of the molecule there that's in orange would be hydrophilic, okay, because it has electronegative elements in it. Or it would be polar, I guess you could say. I should use the word hydrophilic. But it is polar, okay? The bottom part of the molecule down here is nonpolar. So what the term hydrophilic and hydrophobic mean, hydro means water, philic means to love. So these are water-loving parts of the molecule. Hydrophobic means water-hating, okay? So those would be the nonpolar parts of the molecule. All right. Any questions? So sometimes in your textbook, you'll see this, something that looks like this quite a bit, a drawing that looks like this. And what this represents is it represents a phospholipid. The circular part of the molecule, as it's drawn here, represents the hydrophilic part of the molecule. The two long tails represent the hydrophobic or nonpolar long hydrocarbon chains in the molecule. Any questions? All right, the next group of biologically important compounds that we mentioned were the carbohydrates. And the functional groups of carbohydrates are simple sugars. Okay. These are, in this picture here, we show three different simple sugars: glucose, galactose, and fructose. And you'll notice that they have one thing in common. They're all ring structures. And typically, sugars are ring structures. However, there are straight chain sugars. However, as far as we're concerned in this class, we're only going to look at ringed sugar structures just to make life easier for you guys. Okay. But notice, well, first of all, what this ring represents is it's kind of a chemist's shorthand. At each of these corners, unless otherwise indicated, there should be a carbon here. So at this corner there's a carbon, at this corner there's a carbon, and so forth. The same thing over here. But at one of the corners, instead of a carbon, what we have here is we have an oxygen. Okay. So a sugar is a ring structure, a carbon ring, except for at one corner, instead of having a carbon, there's an oxygen at the corner. Okay. So that's how we define sugars. So a sugar is a ring structure with an oxygen in the ring. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, how do we get from a simple sugar to a complex sugar or a complex carbohydrate? What do you think? Should be an easy question.
Covalent bonds.
Okay, through covalent bonding, through what process? You're right. Condensation. Remember condensation? Okay. So essentially, if we have two sugars, for example, we have two glucose molecules here, we take the OH group from one sugar, a hydrogen from the other sugar, and that gives us water, right? And then what's going to happen is this oxygen is actually going to bond to this carbon right here, and you see that right shown here in the picture. So that oxygen bonds between the two simple sugars. So that's the process of condensation, right? Okay. So if we had something three sugars long, we would have to go through two condensation events. If we had something 10 sugars long, we would have to go through 9 condensation events. If we had something 1,000 sugars long, we'd have to go through 999 condensation events. Any questions about that? How would we break this molecule down, this complex sugar? Through hydrolysis, right? So we would actually break this bond right here, break the water molecule, and basically go backwards from what we've been talking about with condensation. Okay? Any questions?
That was a complex carb. You said that was
what we call a disaccharide or two sugars, but it's that's how you would make a complex carbohydrate.
Okay, so that.
Would you physically do that just by adding water?
No, just adding water doesn't do it. Actually, there needs to be something that we call enzymes, and we'll talk about enzymes a little bit later associated with it. One of the main things that our cells are going to produce is they're going to produce proteins, and enzymes are proteins. The main protein that's produced are enzymes in our cells. And the reason why we produce so many enzymes is so that we can go through these chemical processes. Okay? And so it's just kind of a helper to get through these chemical processes. And we'll talk about how that happens a little bit later on. Okay? So here in this hamburger, we have three complex carbohydrates that it's showing here. We have starch, which is the storage form of energy in plants. We find that in the bread, okay, or in the bun. We have glycogen, which is the storage form of energy in animals. We find that in the beef, okay, or whatever else you're putting on your hamburger. And then we have the cellulose, which is found in the lettuce, makes up the plant cell walls. Now we can tell that all of these are complex carbohydrates just simply by all of these ring structures bonded together. That's a very simple way of telling that something's a carbohydrate. And the way that we get these complex carbohydrates again is through multiple processes of condensation. Now the difference between these three different types of carbohydrates is how the sugars are put together, as you can see here. Cellulose has row after row of sugar, essentially. Okay. Glycogen has some branching structures. Starch has some branching structures, but they're not quite as complex as the glycogen. Okay. Now, you don't need to remember the difference between the three different types of carbohydrates, at least their chemical structure. But you should realize that these are carbohydrates because they have multiple ring structures and hooked together, and so they're complex carbohydrates. Okay. Any questions? Okay, the next group of molecules then that we listed were the nucleic acids. And the nucleic acids, their functional groups are something that we call nucleotides. And nucleotides are made up of three things: a phosphate group, a sugar, and a base. And I'm going to put N in parentheses here because it's nitrogenous base, what we call a nitrogenous base. Okay. So let's look at this nucleotide that we have on the board here. Okay. Now you'll notice this, you probably should have recognized this is a sugar. How do we tell that this is a sugar? It's a ring structure with what in one corner? Oxygen. Okay, so this is a sugar. So we find sugars both in nucleic acids and in carbohydrates. How do we tell the difference between a nucleic acid then and a carbohydrate? They both have sugars in them. Yeah?
Sure.
Exactly. In carbohydrates, sugars are bonded to other sugars. In nucleotides, those sugars are bonded to two other things: a phosphate group, which is represented by the P here, and also something that we call a base. And I put up here in parentheses that it has an N in it. These are what we call nitrogenous bases. Now notice these are ring structures as well. But instead of having oxygens in some of the corners, what do we have? Nitrogen in some of the corners instead of oxygen. Okay, does that make sense to everybody?
Are they still the carbons in the other corners?
Yeah, still always carbon here. And if there's no hydrogen sticking off, it's assumed, it's chemist shorthand, that there's also hydrogen there. Okay. If you're a chemist and you're drawing all of these structures, sometimes there's just shorthand ways of doing it. Okay. So a nucleotide is made up of a phosphate, a sugar, and a base. All right. So we have the sugar with the oxygen in the ring. Then our base is a nitrogenous base. It has nitrogen in some of the corners instead of oxygen. And then also attached to the sugar is a phosphate group, something with a P inside of it. Okay. So here's the structure of ATP. We're not going to get into real specifics yet. Later on in the semester we'll talk specifically about adenosine triphosphate and its chemical structure. What I want you to see now is that it's made up of a nucleotide. This nucleotide has a phosphate group here, a sugar, and a base. Okay. Now, in adenosine triphosphate, it shouldn't surprise you too much that there are three phosphate groups, right? Because in the name, adenosine triphosphate, tri means three. If we look at a strand of nucleic acids, this is something like RNA. Notice that it's made up of repeating nucleotides, okay? So here we have a phosphate sugar base, phosphate sugar base, phosphate sugar base, okay? Doesn't show the phosphate up here, but phosphate sugar base. So basically, DNA and RNA are made up of repeating nucleotides, or different types of nucleotides, but it's nucleotide after nucleotide in a long strand, okay? So they're made up of phosphate sugar base units. Any questions about that? Okay. Any questions about nucleic acids for now? We'll come back and talk about the specific chemical structure of ATP, DNA, and RNA a little bit later on in the semester. The last group of biologically important compounds that we mentioned were the proteins. Okay. And proteins, their functional groups are what we call amino acids. And amino acids are made up of an amino group and a carboxyl group. And both the amino and the carboxyl we're going to put out here are attached to the same carbon, okay? But anybody remember what the chemical structure of carboxyl is? COOH, okay? So we'll put that here. And amino group, its chemical shorthand is NH2, okay? That's an amino group. And both the amino and the carboxyl are bonded to the same carbon, is what that shorthand means there, okay? So if we look at a generalized amino acid, it would look something like this. We have a central carbon here, okay? And that was represented by this, all right? We have this central carbon, and attached to that central carbon is an amino group. The amino group has is represented by a nitrogen and two hydrogens, or NH2, okay? We also have a carboxyl group here bonded to the central carbon. Carboxyl is C, double bonded to an O, single bonded to an O, single bonded to an H, right? One additional thing that we have always attached to the central carbon is this hydrogen molecule right here. So there's another hydrogen attached to the carbon. So I guess if we wanted to write it this way, we could put C bonded to an H, okay? The other part of the molecule is what we sometimes call the R group. R stands for residual, okay? Residual means what is left, okay? What is left over. So what it's talking about there, it's what is left over after we already look at the functional group of the amino acid, or the functional groups of the amino acid, all right? And that is what is going to make the different amino acids different, is that R group, all right? So all amino acids are going to have this carboxyl group bonded to the central carbon, an amino group bonded to the central carbon, and this hydrogen bonded to the central carbon. And in addition, there's going to be an R group bonded to the central carbon. Okay. Any questions about that?
What's that R group represent?
Whatever's left over. Okay, and I'll show you some here in just a minute. Okay. So just for an example here, we have two amino acids that is showing here, the amino acid glycine and the amino acid alanine, all right? Now, if we look at these two amino acids, here's the central carbon of glycine, right? We have the carboxyl group here, the amino group here, and the hydrogen that's normally attached to the central carbon. So what is the R group in glycine? Just a hydrogen, okay? So that's the R group in glycine. That's the simplest of the amino acids. In the amino acid alanine, we have the carboxyl group, the amino group, the hydrogen, all bonded to the same central carbon. So the R group in alanine is CH3. Does that make sense? So they're actually, the R group is what is left over after the functional group. Now, with amino acids, there are only 20 different amino acids in the world, Okay. You could easily memorize the structure of all of the R groups in the amino acids. Maybe not easily, but you could do it, okay, if you really wanted to. In fact, if you take some major biology classes, you have to learn the chemical structure of all of those R groups. And 20 isn't that many. So every protein in the world is made up of only 20 different amino acids. Any questions about that? So that's kind of, that may be shocking to you, maybe not, maybe you haven't thought about it. But if you think about it, if we have a protein that's 1,000 amino acids long, which is not uncommon, okay, the only way that it differs from other proteins is in the order of the different types of amino acids or different types of residual groups within that molecule. Okay. Any questions?
So in that 1,000, you're probably going to find all 20 different.
Oh, you may or may not find the 20 different.
But then, like, it could differ just by the ordination, like just switch to and change it.
Yeah, just the order of them. So if you had one 3 amino acids long, and you only had 2 different amino acids, your number of different proteins that you could produce would be actually 3. Okay. So, you know, if you had an amino acid 1,000, or if you had a protein 1,000 amino acids long, the number of different types of proteins that you could produce would be 1,000 factorial divided by 2. Maybe you know what that means. If you had college algebra, do you remember factorial, what that means? It's like if you had 1,000 factorial, what that means is it means 1,000 times 999 times 998 times 997, so on. Okay. So it's a lot of different proteins to produce. Any questions about that? Now, how do we make complex proteins out of amino acids? That's the next question. Well, the answer should be fairly simple through the process of what?
Condensation,
right. Okay, almost messed up there. So we take an OH group from the carboxyl, an H group from the amino group, and we break that off and produce water, and then the nitrogen bonds to the carbon, or the amino nitrogen bonds to the carboxyl carbon. Okay, and so that's a bond between these two amino acids. Now, if we wanted to break this amino acid or this protein down, what would we do? We'd go through hydrolysis. We break this bond, break the water, and just basically go backwards. Now, one thing I didn't mention with the nucleic acids, the same thing is true with nucleic acids. When we want to add two nucleotides together, that's done through the process of condensation. When we want to break a nucleic acid apart, we break the nucleotides apart through the process of hydrolysis. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay. The next topic that I want to talk just briefly about, actually not briefly, but I want to talk a bit about, is how scientists go about looking at the world. Now we know a little bit about chemistry. What I want to talk about is something that is called the scientific method. Most of you have probably at least been introduced to this before in a high school or middle school science class, even though you may not have listened. Okay. And so now you need to listen. Basically, the scientific method is how scientists go about looking at the world. Okay. The scientific method has 3 basic steps. The first step in the scientific method is observation. Okay. Observing the world around you and then asking questions. That's the very first step in being a scientist. And actually, it's kind of interesting. When you were a small kid, you were probably a much better scientist than you are today. Okay? I don't know about you guys, but if you've ever been around little kids, they're constantly asking questions about the world around them, right? Okay? In fact, when you guys get to be parents, it'll drive you insane sometimes. I have a little boy that's a little bit over 2 years old right now, and it's always, you know, what's this? You know, he always says, how? That means, how does it work? Like, you can explain everything, how it works, you know, and just go straight through, or he'll ask where somebody is or something. But he's constantly asking questions, right? And all of us are basically scientists when we're really little. Eventually what happens is our parents don't have the answers to all of our questions, or our teachers don't have the answers to all of our questions, and they have too much pride to tell you that they don't have the answer. They just tell you what. That's just the way it is, right? Okay? And so you stop asking questions. But the most important thing that you can do to be a good scientist is to ask lots of questions. I tell my upper division biology classes, you guys can ask me all the questions you like, and I may not know the answer to hardly any of them. Okay? And that's the beauty of science, is we don't know the answer to everything. Alright? So observing something, asking questions, is the first step in the scientific method. Let me give you an example. Back here in the back of the classroom, we have a picture of some trees called quaking aspen trees. We find them up the mountain. Many of you have seen quaking aspen trees before. They're quite beautiful in the fall, at least. Okay. Throughout the western United States, quaking aspen trees are disappearing. Okay, and they're being replaced by conifer trees. Typically, you guys think of conifer trees as pine trees. However, they're not all pine trees. Okay. But they're replaced by trees with needles. In Utah alone, there are 5,000 to 10,000 acres of quaking aspen trees that are being lost every year. Okay. In Colorado, somewhere around 80% to 90% of all of the quaking aspen forests have been lost over the last 15 to 20 years. Okay. So the question is, why are we losing quaking aspen trees? Okay, that's an observation, it's a question. Right? Any questions? Now, the next step in the scientific method is to have a hypothesis. Okay? And a hypothesis is just an educated guess that can be something that we call falsifiable. Okay? So we could come up with some educated guesses or some hypotheses as to why quaking aspen trees are being replaced by conifer trees, right? I'm going to ask you to come up with some in a minute. Now, before you come up with those hypotheses, however, those hypotheses must be able to be proven false. That's something that a lot of people don't understand about the scientific method, is we must be able to prove it false. All right. So, for example, you could say that some being, higher being, is coming down here and pulling the quaking aspens out or pouring poison on them and killing them, okay, some sort of magical poison. That's not a valid hypothesis because, what, you can't test it, okay? Does that make sense to everybody? You can't prove it false, right? So the last step in the scientific method is experimentation. So you must be able to prove it false through experimentation. Now before we get into these hypotheses, I want to just kind of delve into a little bit of a philosophical discussion. Okay? How many of you have philosophy in here? Oh man, you guys are lucky.
What about philosophy from Bart?
No, that doesn't count. Philosophy, all of you ought to take philosophy classes. It'll make your mind kind of warp a little bit, right? Okay. To make you think about the world in different ways. One of the things that they talk about in philosophy is what is truth. Okay? Truth is something that's really, really hard to define. Well, in science, by definition, we've defined what scientific truth is. Okay? Truth is something that you can experiment with and you can't prove it false. Okay? So in other words, scientists never really know if anything is true. They just know that it's more true or less true. Okay? Or false. They can know if it's false by definition. All right. So in other words, we're going to come up with some hypotheses. We're going to come back to that here in a minute. So what are some plausible hypotheses as to why quaking aspen trees are disappearing from the forest and they're being replaced by conifer trees? Come on, you guys need to come up with some hypotheses. Yeah.
Could it have to do with the conifer tree roots maybe getting in the way of the quaking aspen's roots and taking all the water?
Okay, so maybe the conifer tree roots are basically choking out the, for lack of a better term, the quaking aspen tree roots are stealing all of the good stuff in the soil. Could we experiment with that? Could we prove it false?
Yeah.
sure, we could plant the two together and look at the roots and actually put radioactive isotopes in the soil and see which tree was getting those radioactive isotopes and stuff, right? Okay, another hypothesis.
Climate change?
Okay, maybe climate change is causing that. Could you prove that false? Yeah, you could actually take them and put them in greenhouses of different temperatures, right? See if they competed with one another at different temperatures. Yeah.
I'm not sure how the quaking aspens regrow their young, but with the pine tree type, they drop the pine cones. And I know pine trees drop a lot of needles on the ground that might saturate the ground, not allow the young for the Quakers to grow up until there's a fire, which would burn out all the needles, but at the same time would open the pine cones to enable the birth of more pine trees.
Okay, you're really close, actually, in some ways. Okay. But actually, quaking aspen trees have a more efficient way of reproducing, which we call asexual reproduction. Hmm. They actually sucker. So they actually grow underneath the ground and grow a new tree.
Yes.
Okay. So, but that's something we could experiment with, right? We could bring quaking aspen trees into a greenhouse and we could put pine needles on the ground. Okay, yeah. Another hypothesis.
Maybe, I was going to say maybe a bark beetle that clusters inside of a tree and the replacement would be a tree that they don't live in or...
Okay, so maybe some disease organism that's killing off the quaking aspen trees. Could we experiment with that? Sure, we could actually, it'd be a little bit tougher. Well, we would have to use actually a line of evidence that sometimes is not as sure as experimentation, but, and we'll talk about that, we'd have to use something called correlative evidence. Okay, we'll talk a little bit about that, yeah.
Is it something bugs?
Okay, bugs, any other ideas? Yeah.
Maybe because of the natural cycle of things, after a fire,
Because
wildfires, it doesn't allow for those to go back to
full time. Okay, so maybe we're altering the ecosystem, and we could actually experiment with that, right? Okay, one other.
The pine trees are really tall and stuff, and they block out the sun, so that new quaking aspens can't grow up underneath them.
Okay.
And so they eventually choke up all the light.
Okay, so could we experiment with that hypothesis? Yeah, we could. We could actually put little fake umbrellas up, right, there, or something like that, and see if quaking aspen trees die. Well, what has happened is scientists have actually experimented. A lot of you guys are really close as to what we think is happening with quaking aspen trees, or what we have, or, you know, we haven't been able to prove false, the hypothesis. The hypothesis is this, is that pine trees shade quaking aspen trees. And what happens is quaking aspen seedlings can't grow when there's not full sunlight. Okay, and so as the pine trees start to grow up, pine trees actually have to have a little bit of shade to start their seedling stages. So the pine trees use the shade from the quaking aspen trees to start growing in a little bit of shade. And then as the pine trees get taller, they eventually shade out the quaking aspen trees. Okay. Now the reason behind this is actually something else that you guys touched on. And the reason why pine trees are actually growing up into quaking aspen trees is because of lack of fire. Since the turn of the century, about the early 1900s, we had this idea that we should stop all forest fires. How many of you have heard that forest fires are bad? Only you can prevent forest fires, right? Smokey the Bear. From an ecological perspective, Smokey the Bear is the worst thing that ever happened to the forests in the United States. Because we're actually losing quaking aspen forests. And quaking aspen forests are very, very important. Not only for the animals and organisms up on the mountain, but also for us down here in the valley in the west. Okay? There's a lot more food underneath quaking aspen trees than pine trees. If any of you have ever walked through a pine forest or a conifer forest, right? There's actually grass growing underneath quaking aspen trees. And so that's where elk and deer and other animals get their food. Not only that, but when you don't have grasses and stuff growing under the trees, when you get a rainstorm, the rain washes off the top of the soil. There's nothing to hold the rain in place. And so down here in the valley where water is such a critical component to our surviving in a sub-desert, right, when you get these large flows of water off the mountain, we don't have the capacity to capture them. And so that water goes down into the bottom of the valley, goes down and out, and eventually into the ocean or into the Great Salt Lake or Sevier Lake in this case, in the case of Santa Fe. Does that make sense? Another thing is that pine trees use about 7 times more water than quaking aspen trees to grow. Okay, so not only is there water running off on the surface, but the plants are actually using more water. That makes less groundwater available for us down in the valley. Okay, and why do they use so much more water?
Their size.
What?
They're bigger, aren't they?
Okay, they're a little bit bigger. That's
all year long.
Yeah, they photosynthesize all year long. They're using water even now in the wintertime. Okay? Not only that, but they tend to be a little bit more drought hardy, because they can actually photosynthesize when quaking aspen trees can't in the middle of the summer too. Okay? And so what happens is they actually use about 7 times more water than quaking aspen. Any questions? So that's just an example of how we would use experimentation to test a hypothesis. We could actually determine whether or not that hypothesis was false. And actually, some of the other hypotheses that you guys have set forward were actually original hypotheses that have been tested and have been proven false. For example, the needle one, okay, changing the soil chemistry. Competition, they've actually done studies with that. It shows that root competition really doesn't have a big factor, isn't a big factor.
What are they doing to slow the progress of the pine trees right now? Or?
Well, the answer is most people in the public are ignorant to the problem. Okay, and most people in the public believe the Smokey the Bear message. Okay, and that our government agencies keep perpetuating this false message. Okay, I guess you could say. And so, I mean, Smokey the Bear goes to my kids' school, you know, at least once a year, maybe twice, and goes in all the parades and everything else. Some of the managers are trying to do things such as prescribed fires. Have you heard of prescribed fires, where they'll actually go and start something on fire on purpose? Or they get a fire and they'll just let it burn. But that is risky for the person in the Forest Service, because if the fire gets out of hand and burns somebody's cabin, then they're responsible for it. So that's why they don't do it very much. Yeah.
But a lot of the prescribed fire, they're doing it to prevent fires.
Yeah, not exactly. Because what happens over a long period of time, if you crowd out the quakies, then you have these conifers. The conifers only live for, most of the conifers in the West have a life cycle of less than 100 years. Okay, so we started suppressing fire over 100 years ago. And so what happens is all of the conifers start dying, or you get some infestations such as we have up here. If anybody's been on the top of this mountain, all the conifers, or a lot of them, are dead due to beetle infestations. Okay, and the reason why the beetle infestations are there, because the conifers are old and the beetles can infest the trees and they just explode in population. But we need a fire. And so when you get all the old conifer trees, they start to dry out. So when you do get a fire in one of those conifer forests that's old and all dried out, what happens? Yeah, you get a fire that is totally unmanageable. Does that make sense? And it burns so hot that it sterilizes the soil for sometimes 3 or 4 years. And you don't have the normal grasses and trees growing back after the fire. So they're trying to kind of nip that problem in the bud. But once the quaking aspen trees are gone, they're pretty much gone. Okay.
So is that the reason why they haven't started the fire up in Barron yet? Because of the soil thing, or is it because...
Oh, they actually did have a fire by Barron last year.
They did?
Black Dragon fire, yeah. Yeah, it burned quite a bit. So, now, let's get back to our philosophical discussion of what is scientific truth. How many of you have heard of a scientific law before? How many of you have heard of something called a theory? Okay. A theory, or a scientific law, is just a real strong scientific theory. And basically the way it works is this. If there was some single line that was the truth, okay, what this scientific method does is, by definition, you must be able to prove something false. You can never, ever prove something true in science. Does that make sense? You can only prove it false by definition. So if we have some hypotheses, we test it, we don't prove it false, it becomes more true. The next time that we test it, we don't prove it false, it becomes more true. Next time we test it, it becomes more true, and so on. And eventually, it comes very close to what we would call our truth line. When we haven't been able to prove that hypothesis false large numbers of time, then we call it a theory, or if we haven't been able to prove it false huge numbers of times, then we call it a scientific law. For example, does gravity exist everywhere on the Earth? Some of you say yes, some of you say no, some of you say, I don't know. The answer is, we really don't know. But so far, if we were to test it everywhere in this classroom, it would probably, you could say with a reasonable degree of certainty, that it exists everywhere, right? Because if I try it here, if I push this marker over, it falls, okay? If I trip, I'm not going to float. Oh, well, it would be nice if I did, but I'm probably going to what? Crash to the ground. So in order to really know if gravity existed everywhere on the Earth, you would have to what? Experiment and prove it, and not be able to prove it false everywhere on the Earth. Does that make sense? But if we tested enough places, in other words, if we tested it everywhere in this room, or, you know, tested it throughout the world, and we were never able to prove it false, then it becomes more true. Does that make sense to everybody? The hypothesis becomes more true. Now, in a lot of so-called sciences, quote-unquote, okay, they use a different method that's not the scientific method. And anytime you have a science that doesn't use the scientific method, I would say that they're not a true science. Okay? There's another line of evidence that you can use to help us out in science, and it's called correlative evidence. Right? And I should mention, before I get into correlative evidence, whenever you test something, whenever you test a hypothesis, one of the questions is, how sure are you that you're getting a result that is valid? Okay. Because sometimes we get results and they're due to error, right? That makes sense. Maybe the person running the experiment does something a little bit wrong. A really good example of this, how many of you have heard of something called cold fusion before? Up at University of Utah, there were some scientists there that said they figured out cold fusion. And what happened was they couldn't repeat their experiments. They had made some errors. Okay, and so the way that we calculate for error in science is you can actually do it by repeating the experiment a certain number of times. Okay, depending on what experiment you're running, the more replications you have to have. And the more times you replicate the experiment or the results of your experiment, then the more sure you can be that the results that you're getting are not just some chance event, right? Does that make sense? Okay. And the way that we actually figure that out is through something that we call statistics. Some of you have statistics. Okay. And usually in biology, we say that if we're 95% sure that something is not due to error or not due to chance, then we call it a theory. Okay, a result, or that's a valid result. Does that make sense? Now, in other sciences, like in physics, they have to be 99.999% sure that the results that they get are not due to chance or error. So it's different in different sciences. Now, here's something kind of interesting. The social sciences, which are like psychology and nutrition and stuff, okay, guess what their standard is? They have to be at least 40% sure that the results they get are not due to random chance. And so that's why you see so many goofy things in nutrition and psychology. You'll hear one thing one day and another thing another day. Because they just have really no standard at all. There's a better chance that the results you get in a psychology experiment are due to chance than they are the results that you're getting are true results. Okay. Yeah?
Who sets the standard? Why is their standard so low?
I don't know why it's so low, to tell you the truth. And it doesn't make much sense. And the other, who sets the standard? It's kind of the group as a whole, I guess you could say, over time. But those are the social sciences are what I would call a pseudoscience, a fake science, because they really, there's no surety that the results you get in any experiment are due to, are not due to error, just random chance. Okay. Any questions? Now, there's also another way of looking at information, and that's correlative evidence. Some evidence we cannot do experiments on. Okay, we just can't. But we can look at evidence and then kind of conclude a result from the lack of or the abundance of evidence. Right? When I teach this class at the prison, the prisoners love this part of the lecture. Okay? If someone, let's say Mr. Steck here, stood up with a rifle, an automatic rifle, and shot half the class and ran out, okay? Then what would happen? They'd catch him, we'd go to court, right? Okay, let's say they caught him alive. Go to court. Could we prove that he did it?
No.
There's no way you could prove that he did it. Absolutely no way you could prove it. Now, if all of the survivors in here pointed and said that Mr. Steck pulled the trigger, then what would that be? Okay. That would be a bunch of evidence, right? If he also had the gun in his hand when the police caught him, and he had residue because he had fired the gun, and we found where he had purchased the ammunition at the store, the receipt, and so forth, those would all be lines of evidence that would point towards the conclusion that he actually what? Did the crime, right? Does that make sense? But we could never prove with 100% surety that he actually did the crime. That's correlative evidence. Okay, so we take evidence out there, that's out there in the world, and it points to a conclusion. A good example of a science that uses correlative evidence quite extensively is something that we call paleontology. Okay, paleontology is the study of fossils. And so, growing up, you may have heard that dinosaurs were reptiles. Many of you have ever heard that. Some of you might have heard that they're birds. You heard that? Now, actually, we don't think they were either reptiles or birds. The reason why it's kind of changing is because the more evidence the paleontologists get about dinosaurs from the fossil record, the better the picture they have. Does that make sense? So correlative evidence is when you have lines of evidence that point toward a specific conclusion.
Does that use more when you can't really like form a hypothesis?
Yeah, when you can't experiment with something. Uh-huh. Like we couldn't experiment with this crime bit, right? So like I tell the prisoners in the prison, they can never prove that you actually did the crime. Right? And they think that's just the best. That's a great philosophical argument. They come back for like weeks on end talking about the philosophy of correlative evidence, and because most of them were convicted on correlative evidence, unless they ratted themselves out or whatever, right? But with correlative evidence, typically that's not as strong as the scientific method because we can't experiment. And so a lot of times you will see opinions change or conclusions change depending on how much or how little evidence is present. Does that make sense to everybody? So the more evidence, obviously, the more sure you can be of your conclusion. Does that make sense? Okay. The less evidence, the less sure you can be of your conclusion. Right? And so with correlative evidence, it's all a matter of how much evidence you have that points to a specific conclusion. Okay. Any questions about the scientific method? All right. On Wednesday, we're going to start talking about the cell. There are actually two chapters in your text on the cell. I would suggest you read both of them before you come to class on Wednesday. The reason why is I kind of jump back and forth between the two chapters when I'm teaching about the cell. And so read both chapters on the cell before you come to class.